everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. And here we are. It's time for another episode of It's All About Food. And I have to tell you, I'm really looking forward to this program a bit selfishly, and I'll tell you why. If you listened to my last program, you could tell, I think, that I was feeling a bit emotional, a bit melancholy, a bit frustrated, and I know many people are feeling all kinds of emotional feelings. Our world has been turned around, and well, we'll see where the pieces fall, but I think we need to stay vigilant and stay in tune with what's going on and stay strong with our integrity and our values and our morals and stand up for what we know and feel. All right. Now, the reason why I'm looking forward to this program today is I have two guests on that I found messages in their books and their writing that are helping me right now to feel inspired and know that there's a lot of work ahead, but there's a lot of reason to stay on the path, to keep working for what we believe in. Now is not a time to give up on anything. So for those of you who are new to the program, I'm Karen Hartglass. This show is called It's All About Food. Most of the time we talk about food. Sometimes we talk about things that are connected to our food choices, health of our individual bodies, health of the planet, treatment of the animals, and many, many other subjects that are connected with food. The food system is so complicated. And I personally came to this way of thinking a long time ago. I was a teenager. I didn't want to kill animals. And it grew into so much more because everything is connected. And what we put on our plate is connected to everything in our lives. Now, inspiration. Let's get to what got me inspired. And to do that, I want to bring on my first guest, Robin Raven. And she is the author of a book called Santa's First Vegan Christmas. She holds a BFA from the School of Visual Arts. And she has a website, robinraven.com. And I want to welcome Robin to the program right now. How are you, Robin?
Hi, Karen. Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, well, I remember you contacted me a long, long time ago, early in the year, about this book.
Yes.
I have to admit that the way I work, because I always have so much on my to-do list, I typically read books I'm going to talk about a day before, 2 days before, the day of, so that it's fresh in my mind. And so I've had your book, Santa's Vegan Christmas, for a long time, and I just read it today, and it brought me to tears.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. Thank you.
It did. It's such a beautiful story and a wonderful message. And I like to say that we need to voice the things that we want. We need to put out into the global consciousness an image of the world the way we would like to see it. And, you know, there may be people who say, oh, my God, that's not possible. That's such a fantasy. We'll never do that. But until we start painting that picture and creating that vision and sharing it with what I like to call the global consciousness, it won't happen. We have to put it out there. And your book creates such a beautiful image of what this world could be.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about this book. It's I would like to say it's a children's picture book, or is it? But it's kind of for everyone, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, so what's nice is I've had people of all different ages enjoy it, so that makes me so happy.
Yeah, and you kind of took a spin off of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas kind of story.
Yes, I was inspired to write it because I was watching a lot of Christmas movies because I'm a huge fan of the holidays, and I noticed that there was like this casual violence within the Santa world that's just sort of accepted without question, which I think is just so conditioned and so a part of the fictional landscape that people don't even notice it's going on. But in many old depictions of Santa, he's carrying a whip, and a lot of art like shows him midair about to strike the reindeer. And even in different films, like Santa's depicted with a whip and the reindeer are all tied up. And so I was just taken aback by the casual violence in the holiday tales that goes unaddressed by otherwise like wonderful characters and the heroes of the stories. And so it just made me think of how animals are treated cruelly in real life. And it reminded me of instances in my own life where I've seen animal abuse or encountered injustice. And so I was inspired to write the lead character of the story, Dana, who's this strong, independent reindeer who stands up for what she thinks is right.
Yeah. Now, vegans are troublemakers, aren't we? We're really troublemakers because we take such a beautiful thing that people see as so beautiful, and we kind of point out some of the things that are not so lovely about it. We're troublemakers.
Right. We are.
Yeah. Well, we're troublemakers for some, but we're liberators for others.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's making me think about, who wrote The People's History of the United States, Howard Zinn, where we're raised as children and students to perceive history the way the author wrote it, usually from the perspective of the victor. And there's a whole different story from those who've been oppressed. It's a whole different story. And we need to look at all sides of every story, even 'Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Yeah. You're so right. That the People's History of the United States, it was such a life-changing book for me. And it is important to speak up even in fictional ways sometimes.
No, absolutely. I'm believing in art, all kinds of art, writing and theater and song more than ever. And as the funding gets taken away to support the arts more and more, and we will probably see it stripped away even more in the United States with the new government that's going to take over. Artists, writers, journalists will have to struggle even more and go underground even more. But the message that artists bring is really important. So you've done that in your simple, little, beautiful, beautifully illustrated storybook. Can you tell me about the person who illustrated your book?
Yes, I'm so lucky. Cara Maria Shunk is the book's illustrator, and she's incredible. She has beautiful illustrations, and she was assigned to the book by my wonderful publisher, Vegan Publishers, who published the book. And I was so amazed the first time I saw her artistic depiction of Dana, because I teared up a little bit because she totally got it and she got what I was trying to say with the story. And I feel like she adds a lot to the story too with her art and in the way it's illustrated. I was very happy with how the book turned out.
Yeah. Okay, now let's back up and talk about Robin and get a little idea of how you formulated your personal philosophy.
I've actually been a vegetarian since I was a kid, like 10 years old. I always, always loved animals from my earliest memory, felt the connection with them. So when I really realized, I made the connection between what we eat and animals, and I can never eat meat again. And then I became a vegan more recently, and I'm vegan for life now. I wish I'd done a lot sooner. But yes. I think that now more than ever, as you were mentioning about some recent developments in November going on in the world, I think that no one issue that we're facing is independent of the others right now. And so I think the case for animal rights also stands alongside other forms of prejudice that we need to address. So I think that it's really important to stand up against all kinds of prejudice now more than ever, whether it's against somebody for their citizenship, their race, their gender, sexual orientation, size, or their species. I think it's really important to have an intersectional approach to activism.
Yeah, I've always taken the broad view, racism, homophobia, sexism, speciesism, all of those isms are really the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just hard for everyone to see it that way. And we tend to get more progress for humans in general if we manage a single issue. People mm-hmm. have a hard time swallowing the big picture for some reason, but it is all mm-hmm. the same.
True.
Yeah.
That's a great point. Yeah.
And I think veganism in particular is a great form of activism, because when we're feeling frustrated that we can't do anything to make change, we can at least change what's on our plate.
So true.
Several times a day. And that is very powerful, and it can lead to so much more. So, for all of you frustrated people out there that want to make a difference, if you haven't done so already, leave our non-human friends off of the plate.
Yes, please.
Yes, please. Putting it out there. Are you writing any other books? Do you have another story lined up?
I do. I have several works in progress. Hopefully I'll have concrete news on that soon. But absolutely, I'm excited about several future projects. And it's not the last you'll hear from Dana either. So.
Oh, good. Bring Dana back.
Yes, Dana's going to come back. She has lots
that's
more
funny.
To say.
And so I'm wondering what the feedback has been. Has the book been released already? Yes.
It has. It was released in the summer, and I can't tell you how touched I am by the response. The Holiday, the latest issue of Veg News, there's a wonderful review of it, and other magazines like Vegan Health and Fitness and Animal Times and Action Line and Naked Food Magazine, they all have reviews of the book and the recent issues. I'm very, very honored and very touched that it's received such positive reception. And I heard from a parent the other day that told me that they are going to read the book now as part of their holiday tradition every year on Christmas Eve for their children. And I just teared up hearing that, because that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, as an artist, and writers are included in artists, and it's really a lesson for everyone, but we really shouldn't care what other people think of us and of our works. But every time we put something out there that kind of challenges the status quo, we're going to get some pushback.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when, I'm grabbing for her name right now. I'm going to have to come back with it. But I'm sure there are some people that might be upset by the story.
Yes. And
I
was really concerned about that and worried about that, because I expected that, considering that I'm, making a pretty bold statement here about a long-held tradition. But I haven't gotten very much of that. I got this angry email from someone who is angry about Santa at all, which is kind of funny. They sent me a long sermon about how Santa is, you can spell Satan out of the letters from Santa, and that it's an evil book because of that.
I like that.
Had, I haven't had a pushback that I thought I would, actually. People have been embracing it, but I've struggled with self-esteem and self-confidence in the past, so it feels a little weird to be talking about how people have praised the book, but I was just really, really touched and humbled by its reception.
I wanted to mention the author Ruby Roth, who wrote a number of books specifically for children. That's Why We Don't Eat Animals, Vegan is Love, V is for Vegan. And there were some people that thought that her books weren't appropriate to share with children because they talk about factory farming and they tell the truth in a very in a simple way that's approachable for children, I think, with some really lovely drawings. But still, people didn't want to share this information with children. And then you have to wonder, if you don't want to share this information, why do you support it at all?
Exactly. You know, I saw an interview of Ruby Roth, too, and I thought, wow, she handled that well because the reporter was obviously antagonistic. But everything, she was so grace under pressure. So I admire her. I love seeing her interviews.
Yeah, so anyway, what I wish for you is no negative criticism, but you may get it, and just be as strong and courageous as you can be, because you have a beautiful story. And I love rewriting traditions, because what we don't realize is the traditions we have are dynamic. They're not stagnant. They're always changing. Mm-hmm. Even though we call them traditions and say it's something that we've done for hundreds of years, thousands of years, they're always changing. And we can make all of our traditions better.
It's so true. I think what a lot of people don't realize when they first hear about people going vegan, they imagine, oh, gross tasting food and, you know, depriving of all their happy traditions and that it would be miserable. But I found the opposite is true. I've gotten so much happier when I do vegan stuff and when I change traditions to be kinder. Like, there are about, like, I think 20 different types of, you know, turkey alternatives that are vegan now that are easy to make or buy. And it's easy to change traditions, then they're more fun and happy too. It doesn't hurt anybody.
No question about that. Last week was Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving is a very emotionally charged holiday for many people, just because they're getting together with the family and everyone. So many people seem to have issues with family members. The ones that they want to be with, the ones they don't want to be with. But then we all have so many different food requirements these days, and the vegans really spoil it because we don't like having the turkey on the table. How was your Thanksgiving?
Oh, it was lovely. I spent it with my family, and we all had the guardian turkey, the non-turkey, the tofu-based turkey. So it was really good, really fun.
We were with my partner's family in California, and it was an opportunity where I wasn't responsible for any of the cooking, and that hasn't been so for a while. And many of the family members made sure we had a lot of things to eat, but I didn't have any of. Well, I didn't have some of the foods that I love to have on Thanksgiving, like my vegan pumpkin pie. So I just made one last night.
Oh, good idea.
And I had a slice just before the program started. And if anybody is interested in making a fabulous pumpkin pie, I think this recipe is. It's vegan, it's gluten-free, it's light and custardy. And you can find it at responsibleeatingandliving.com. It's easy and very, very yummy. And I might have to have another piece after this program is over.
Oh, wow. You know, I'm going to check it out right after this interview. I pumpkin pie is like my all-time favorite food. So I'm really excited to get your recipe.
Yeah, part of it is the crust. So I don't have any gluten intolerances, but I like to bake gluten-free. And I came up with this pie crust. And a lot of people are afraid of rolling pie crusts. And I find that this recipe in this dough is so easy to use and forgiving. you know, if it cracks or splits, you could just take a little of it and press it right back in there. It's like Play-Doh. But it tastes great. So it's
fantastic.
Easy. It tastes great. And the custardy pumpkin pie, oh, it's so good.
Oh, that sounds good. I think I'm going to have to make it this weekend.
Yeah. Definitely. Okay, so Santa had his first vegan Christmas. And I have to say, I'm not a religious person. And I was raised Jewish, although we did have exposure to Christmas and Christmas gifts and Santa Claus. My sister had a fear of Santa Claus, you know, some strange guy coming down the chimney. I mean, we didn't even have a chimney, but it was like, whoa, that's scary.
Right, I get that. I've heard that about people before.
What I liked about your Santa in your book was he was on the slim side. Was that intentional?
You know, that's not how I had read it or envisioned it, but that was on the creative end with the publisher and the illustrator, and I think it worked out great for
Absolutely.
The story. I love the Santa, the way she depicted him. I love
So. Okay, so now for kids that are going to be waiting for Santa Claus this Christmas, what kind of treats might they leave for Santa Claus this year?
I hear he loves almond milk and soy milk and even cashew milk.
Right. And any kind of vegan cookie, right?
Yeah, vegan cookies. Yeah, he likes all kinds of vegan cookies. So.
That's great. Well, anything else you want to talk about this book? Where can people find it?
You can find it. Vegan Essentials just started carrying it. You can find it at my publisher's website, veganpublishers.com. It's also available at the PETA catalog. PETA's carrying it. It is available at Annie's Bookstop in Massachusetts. It's available on Amazon.com, too. So.
Right.
And it can also be if it's not in your local Barnes & Noble or independent bookstore, it can be special ordered from any bookstore as well.
Yeah. Well, it's got a thumbs up big recommendation for me. It's really a beautiful book, and I needed to read it today. I needed to put that image in my mind and all around me and just sit with it, because the images that have been flashing across my screen these last few weeks are not good.
Yes. Oh, I so agree. And I find it really touching that you did embrace the book, and that did help. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Robin, I really wish you tremendous success with this book. Now, you have a website, robinraven.com.
Yeah.
And is there anything going on there? Because I tried to see your blog and I didn't get anything.
I'm actually revamping the website this week. There should be more on there right now. There's some basic information on the site, but yeah, it's being revamped this week and the blog should be back up.
Okay, great. So for most people who will probably be listening to this after today, it'll probably be up there and ready to go and read.
Absolutely, yes.
For when we're ready. Great. Okay. Terrific. Thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. I'm glad that we finally had an opportunity to chat and connect after all this time. And we'll talk again sometime in the future.
I'm looking forward to it, Karen. It was such a pleasure to talk to you. Have a wonderful
day.
Okay.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Woo. Merry Vegan Christmas.
Merry Vegan Christmas and a Happy Vegan New Year to everyone. Thank you, Robin. Yes. Okay, that was Robin Raven. Robin Raven with a V, R-A-V, like Victor E-N. Robin Raven, Santa's first vegan Christmas. Yes. Let's say yes together. You know, we have so many things that can make the winter holidays, Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's, vegan. We have silk nog in the store. You could make your own eggnog that's vegan. We have, you might remember it from last year, you might not, but I invite you to revisit responsibleeatingandliving.com. We have posted our feast of the seven dishes created by my partner, Gary DiMatte. This is a beautiful menu of fabulous recipes, special recipes. You can try them all or one or another, but this is for a gourmet, lovely holiday celebration. Foods you haven't seen anywhere, and they're made from real plant foods. So I invite you to check that out at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Feast of the Seven Dishes. It's a play on Feast of the Seven Fishes, right? Right. Yes. So let's take a quick little break. And when we come back, we're going to get to partying, because my next guest, Jeanette Hurt, has written a book called Drink Like a Woman. And I can't wait to share some of what's inside that book. So we'll be right back.
Progressive Radio Network, the number one network for those who care about the truth.
Ladies and gentlemen of America, we extend a special invitation to you to join AJC Radio and our programming every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern. We will be addressing issues that definitely shape a nation and affect America's future. We will also be dealing with members of Congress, shining the spotlight on our initiative called Spotlight on Capitol Hill. You don't want to miss it, folks. Every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time, AJC Radio makes a difference across the nation. We'll see you then.
Love, lust, and laughter. Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm your host, Dr. Diana Wiley, a board-certified sex therapist and a marriage and family therapist. Guests, colleagues, authors are interviewed, and we sometimes dispense advice to create a format that is both informative and entertaining. If you can't listen live, go to the archives and even rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope that you are coming with us.
Hey, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me for the second part of It's All About Food. And moving on, we're going to be talking about something that goes very well with food, and that's drinks, especially cocktails, and some of the stories behind these drinks. So I want to welcome my next guest, Jeanette Hurt. She has a new book out called Drink Like a Woman. Jeanette is the award-winning writer and author of 8 culinary and drink books, and she's a full-time journalist and has written about spirits, wine, and food for thekitchen.com, Four Seasons Magazine, Wine Enthusiast, Entrepreneur.com, Esquire.com, and dozens of other publications. She's a recipient of the 2008 Midwest Travel Writers Mark Twain Award for Best Midwestern Travel Article, and so much more. You can read about her bio on my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Jeanette, welcome to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, when I first saw this book, I thought, yeah, this is fun stuff. And then I read it, and it's more than fun.
I'm so glad you got that part.
Excuse me?
I'm so glad you got that part of the book, because it's fun, but there's a whole lot more going on.
So I don't know what your politics are. My listeners know what my politics are. And the whole election scene has been very disturbing to me. And I've been looking for inspiration all around to continue my work to make the world a better place and to encourage liberty and justice for all. And there are you're including so many stories about great women in this book. They're just brief, but they're enough to remember how women were so discriminated against, the images that many men had about women over the last few hundred years, and of course longer than that, about we could not do. And it's so easy to forget in this current time when we have so much.
That's exactly right. And it was my book focused on the history of women in drink and women in bartending, but it also just goes across the history of women, of course. And the one thing that shocked me in researching this book, well, there were lots of things that shocked me, but until 1971, there was one last state that didn't allow women to bartend.
1971!
Yes. Now, take a guess. Which state was that?
Oh, God. I don't know. Michigan? I don't know.
No, Michigan has another interesting story, but it was California, if you can believe that. California.
Oh, goodness.
And it wasn't until, and the whole story about how California women got the right to bartend, because at one time, 26 states outlawed women bartenders.
Wow.
And
wow.
It didn't start after the end of World War II, but it really continued. If you go back historically, especially in the late 1800s, we went from the early 1800s, late 1700s, and bartending was an okay profession, even for Puritan women. It was okay for them to bartend and own or manage a tavern. In fact, one of my favorite drinks is Start the Revolution, and it's likely that an American woman invented the cocktail, which I think is fantastic. Now, if you go into any sort of cocktail history, you'll hear 1,000 different stories, but the most likely one is that a woman named Catherine Hustler, who was a sutler during the American Revolution, that meant she outfit troops with booze because the troops needed booze in order to fight. And she and her husband had owned a tavern in eastern New York. After the war, they moved to western New York to a town called Lewiston, and they opened another tavern called Hustler's Tavern. And in 1821, a certain American novelist, James Fenimore Cooper, spent his summer there working on his second novel, The Spy, which was, of course, about the American Revolution. And he was so enchanted with Catherine that he based a character on her named Elizabeth Betty Flanagan. And in his book, he describes how Betty created the cocktail. Now, we don't know at which point truth became fiction or fiction became truth, but we do know that she was serving cocktails by 1821 and a lot longer, because she had owned the bar since the early 1800s at that location. And she also was an astute businesswoman. During the War of 1812, she also served British soldiers, so her bar was one of the few buildings in town not to be burned. Mm-hmm. And she was still bartending and managing her tavern when James Fenimore Cooper was working on his novel. So likely he based that character on her recollections of the war. Mm. And I think that's just fabulous. But
it
you go
is.
From 1820s, and it's still okay for women to own and manage taverns. Some places, you know, you had to have a male relative as an overseer or in case something got out of hand. But mostly it was okay. And then you go to the late 1800s, and women weren't allowed in many saloons. In my state of Wisconsin, which at one point was a progressive state, now some people call it a purple state. I guess it depends on who you talk to in my state. But one of the interesting things is women were allowed to drink in Wisconsin taverns, but they had to go through a side or women's and children entrance to the bar. So if you go to historic taverns in Wisconsin, you'll notice they have a back door, they have a front door, and then they have this weird side door. And that was the woman's entrance.
Who makes these things up?
Crazy, right?
It is crazy, yes. But somehow, I don't know, some guys felt better that way.
They must have. But the thing is this continued for a long time. And one of the biggest problems for women who wanted to bartend, because, of course, there's a whole phenomenon of prohibition, which taught women how to drink, because women got to go out and drink in public, which was shocking back then. And after prohibition, there were so many men who were dismayed that there was this one gentleman who wrote an essay about her hooking her French heel over the brass rail and how he lamented the death of the old saloon. And so I have a drink in my book called The Invasion of Women, because he really hated the invasion of women into his sanctity space. Or
hey, I could imagine reading an article like that today on Breitbart. Oh, really? You know, we get that all the time. These kind of twisted stories.
Isn't it? Well, and the interesting thing is of course, after Prohibition, then we had World War II, and a lot of women replaced the male bartenders who went off to war.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they came back, of course, they wanted their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to have the competition from women. And there was a hotel and restaurant workers union, and they represented a lot of bartenders. And they didn't allow women to have membership. They allowed it during the war, but then afterwards they didn't. And then they actively lobbied state and local officials to pass ordinances and state laws against women bartenders. And, of course, there were lots of states doing this, but one such state was the state of Michigan. And Margaret and Valentine Gessert, a mother and daughter duo, decided that when Margaret's husband died, that she should really be allowed to bartend and continue operating the family bar, because in Michigan, you could be a bartender if your husband or father was a bartender or owned the bar.
Mm-hmm.
So they felt that was discriminatory. They hired a very feminist lawyer who represented a lot of women, and she pushed for this. And it worked its way through the Michigan courts, eventually ending up before the United States Supreme Court in Gessert versus Cleary in 1948. And unfortunately, the very sexist Supreme Court justices of the time said, well, of course it wasn't an unchivalrous desire of male bartenders to protect their profession. They just want to protect women. So that set the precedent. Now, one thing I found out after my book went to print is that these plucky Michigan barmaids, as they were known, because female bartenders in that era were known as barmaids, kept pushing their local legislators, so that by 1955, women in Michigan could bartend. However, since the United States Supreme Court had already heard this court case, then all these other states passed laws. They didn't start changing until the 1960s, when, of course, we had the Civil Rights Act and the Equal Pay Act, which allowed women to sue when they were discriminated against in work environments. As we talked about earlier, the last state to hold out was California.
I'm still reeling from that one. I moved to California from New York in 1982, only 11 years after that. And I thought, you know, the world was my oyster. I could do anything. And I had no idea that just 11 years before they had turned that around.
If you had wanted to be a bartender in California, you couldn't. Now, the whole story behind California woman getting the right to bartend, it started with the owner of a strip club called the Classic Cat. And the guy had the idea that after a woman shook something on stage, then they'd go and shake drinks behind the bar. And he, of course, wanted them to be topless. The state Supreme Court in California was ready to dismiss this lawsuit just because they're like, we're not going to touch something about naked woman bartenders. Except there was a very smart female law clerk who had just started working. Her name was Wendy Webster Williams. And she said, I know this sounds really cheesy and sleazy, but it's really about women's rights and women's employment. So her justice said, go ahead, write me a letter explaining why we need to take the case. She convinced him. He convinced the other justices. They took up the case. Not only that, once the briefs started coming in, she realized, well, these are strip club lawyers. They're not so smart. She didn't like their arguments. So she convinced a female law professor and some law students to write an amicus brief, which the strip club lawyers then used. They never got the right to bartend naked, but as a result of this law case, women in California got the right to bartend. And what's amazing is that from that point on, women started joining the profession by leaps and bounds. And today, more than 60% of all bartenders are women. Now, what I find striking about this, I think this is absolutely amazing, especially because back in 1895, 0.2% of all bartenders were women. That meant, to give this a little more perspective, a woman who was a doctor wielding a stethoscope was 50 times more common than a woman wielding a shaker. And of course, you know, 1890s, 1900s, women doctors were not common either.
Yeah. It's a strange world we live in, and I don't pretend to understand any of it. This book is full of many, many wonderful stories like that, and it got me inspired, it got me angry, and it got me wanting to have a drink, that's for sure.
Well, I think that's a good solution when you get frustrated and you need some inspiration. Pick a story, because there's a lot of women who did some amazing things, and that was one fun thing for me. Growing up as a little girl, I loved reading biographies of women who made a difference, people like Harriet Tubman and Susan B. Anthony, and Nellie Bly was one of my favorites. So, of course, I have a Nellie Bly tie instead of a Mai Tai in my book.
Yeah, so the drink names are really wonderful. The Tubmantini and the Dina Colada. Are you calling that Dina or DNA Colada?
DNA really or Dina Colada.
Yes.
And that was a story that shocked me, too, because there's this woman. I remember studying in biology about how DNA was discovered, and I didn't realize that they actually stole research from a female scientist and used that to help them make their conclusions.
Well, you might have been surprised reading it for the first time, but I hope you're not surprised today if you heard something like that, because apparently ethics do not abound.
No, they don't. And there's all sorts of excuses.
Yes. I want to just, for a brief moment, talk about some of the drinks and the ingredients. You may know I'm a vegan. I don't know if you knew that.
Yes,
I do. I went through the whole book, read all the stories, and went through all of the recipes. And I want to tell you that most of the drink recipes are vegan, but the ones that aren't, I can make vegan. So I stamped this vegan friendly, but I want to mention a few things. For people that are concerned about animal ingredients, you can always go to a website called barnivore.com. Are you familiar with barnivore.com, Jeanette?
Love it.
Yeah, it's a great website where it lists what alcohol, beer, wine, and liquor are vegan or not vegan friendly. And if it's not listed, that just means they haven't connected with the producer. So you could email the producer and get back to them to find out what's in the drink. But there are many vegan alcoholic beverages and more. For example, let's talk about Guinness for a minute. I have a silly story where I was living in France as an adult. I came back to New York, and then I went to visit my aunt and uncle for an overnight stay in Connecticut. And they made me dinner, and somehow we got into this macho scenario, my uncle and I, and we ended up doing 6 Guinness stouts chased by shots of tequila.
That's a fabulous story.
And I went to bed. I got up at like 5 in the morning, took a tub, and I was on my way. Because, you know, it's a macho kind of thing to show that you can hold your liquor. And I'm not a big drinker, but I think I got this from my dad where I could handle it. But I discovered that Guinness in the United States is not vegan friendly, although they are working on it and promise that by the end of 2016, they'll have some equipment going where they won't be using the fish gelatin anymore. So I look forward to that. And they're doing it because there's a percentage of people out there of the buying public that want it that way.
Well, and I think most people who like the taste would not be offended if it was vegan.
No, it tastes
good,
the same.
Good booze is good booze.
Exactly.
The other thing, in the meantime, I would suggest is contact some of your local craft brewing producers in your area, because you can always ask them, and usually you can call up the place and talk to the brewer or somebody close to the brewer to find out exactly how they make their beer. And there are a lot of fabulous stouts out there.
Oh, yeah.
So while you're waiting for Guinness, you might...
Yeah, I'm not deprived right now. I have I have all kinds of access to all the booze that I could possibly want. The other thing I wanted to mention, you have a few recipes that require egg whites, and I don't know if you've tried aquafaba yet.
I have not tried it in drinks.
Yeah,
the other
but
the thing is, in general, when people use egg whites, it's for the texture.
Mm-hmm.
But you can take it out, and it will still taste just fine. It might not be as frothy, but who cares if it tastes good?
Right. Well, with bean water aquafaba, which is like the last 2 years has just gone crazy with what you can do with it. I mean, it's great because it's cheap, and it's easy to use, and it doesn't harm anybody. And it makes things really foamy and frothy.
Then that's what you use.
Yeah, and people are using it, which is really exciting. So, yeah, I just wanted to mention those few things. And,
I think those are great ideas.
Yeah, and then, of course, we vegans know then what recipes say use milk or ice cream or whipped cream. We've got in our back pocket all the great substitutes that can work instead of dairy ingredients. I remember the first time I had a white Russian that was vegan, and it was it was in the late 90s.
And I bet it was fabulous.
It was. I was so excited that the bar that I went to in this little place in Burlington, Vermont, actually had non-dairy milk.
Well, most bars also have coconut milk.
Yeah. And that's delicious.
They have to make pina coladas.
Some coconut mixes have dairy in them. Some don't. Depends. You can never be too careful.
I agree.
Yeah, and then Bailey's. I think you have a recipe that calls for Bailey's. And they've been talking about creating a non-dairy version called Almond.
I bet that's really good.
According to what I've read, they didn't realize what they were doing, and they included beeswax in the recipe, and now they're working to get it out because some of us don't want beeswax in our drinks. Yeah. Anyway, they're working on it, and I'm excited because that means, not just for vegans, but when you want to make a product better, for health or the environment or animals, for all life on earth, whatever it is, speak out and talk to the right sources, and we can make change all over the place and then toast to it.
Well, I think you bring up a really valid point, which is you have to know the ingredients of your food.
Mm.
And so many people just take something off the shelf and they don't read the ingredients. And there's so, besides the animal products, there's a lot of different not good for you chemicals in certain foods.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not good for anybody.
There were some liqueurs and drinks that you mentioned that I wasn't exactly familiar with, and I typed it out in Fernet Branca.
That's an Italian liqueur.
Yeah, with herbs and spices? It sounds wonderful.
It is a fantastic bitter liqueur, and it's used in a lot of bartenders love to drink shots of it. It's also good as an aperitif or a digestif, and it's also really good with balancing different flavor profiles of drinks. One of my favorite drinks, which has Fernet Branca, is in Lucille's Balls.
Another great name and another great story.
Yes, which is the drink is a better tasting rum and coke. It's like the best Cuba Libre you'll ever have, and it's using the real cane syrup, cola, lime juice, and Fernet Branca. And something with Fernet Branca and cola just really go really well together. And that recipe comes from Julia Momose, a Chicago bartender who's absolutely amazing. And she's in charge of the Green River bar program.
My favorite drink is the Manhattan.
Ooh.
And I didn't see it in here or a variation on it.
Well, there's the Renaissance Womanhattan.
Oh, I missed it. I'm
so
glad you told me that.
Of course there's a Manhattan, but it's not a Manhattan, it's a Womanhattan.
Of course. Oh, gosh, I'll have to check that out. I'm a fan of bourbon. I like Maker's Mark and anything. And on the rare occasions when I'm feeling ill, like feeling a cold coming on, there's nothing like a warm drink with a little splash of that in there.
A little splash of bourbon, a little
mm-hmm.
splash of fresh lemon juice, maybe a little bit of a sweetener if you need it, but I don't think you need sweetener with bourbon. I think
so. You have the monthly medicinal, which looked really good.
That is another lovely drink. I think it's a good thing because, the story behind that drink is when women were not supposed to drink alcohol, a lot of these medicinals that were sold in pharmacies were really just booze with some herbs and spices added to it.
Mm. Yep. Yeah. Oh, you know, any way to make a buck, you know, they'll just repackage something and get it through and people buy it.
Well, they do.
Yeah,
and they did.
And we should. But anyway, it looks really good with pomegranate liqueur and hibiscus tea and bourbon.
Well, bourbon's wonderful.
Bourbon is wonderful. All right. Well, I really enjoyed reading Drink Like a Woman, Shakespeare, Conquer, Repeat. I'm glad that the first recipe was the one you mentioned, Start the Revolution.
Which I think is it's ongoing, isn't it?
Yeah, we may need to mix up a lot of these, Start the Revolution, because there may be a new one starting soon.
Well, I wanted to add one little thing since holidays are coming.
Yes.
And with that drink or other drinks that have bourbon, one of my favorite things for the holidays is you take 2 cups of bourbon and you take 1 cup of fresh cranberries.
Mm.
You put it in a glass jar and you let it sit for a couple of weeks.
Mm.
And you get this lovely, fragrant, cranberry-fragrant infused booze.
Oh.
And then you can substitute it in any drink that requires bourbon, and it suddenly becomes a holiday cocktail.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. But is it bitter because cranberries need to be sweetened?
No, it isn't.
Wow.
I mean, it's really fragrant. It's red. I think it tastes fabulous.
Okay, so what is the recipe? How much to how much?
2 cups of bourbon, or you could take 2 cups of whatever your favorite spirit is, and 1 cup of fresh cranberries.
Okay.
If you're using a white spirit, I wouldn't let it go for 2 to 4 weeks, which you can let it go with bourbon that long. But if you are using a white spirit, you know, give it a week, maybe a week and a half, and you'll have this red blush colored spirit, which you can then use. Right now I have a batch going with some white rum and some tequila, and then they're both separate, and then also one, of course, with bourbon for the holidays.
I am very excited about that. Thank you, Jeanette, for sharing that with me. I'm doing it. No question about it.
You're very welcome.
Okay, I'm raising a glass to you. Happy holidays. And I really enjoyed reading Drink Like a Woman.
I'm so, so grateful you did. And I have had so much fun talking with you.
Thank you.
If you ever want to talk about cocktails or famous woman, I would love to talk with you again. So
okay,
cheers.
That sounds great. Yeah. Awesome. Happy holidays, and thanks for joining
me.
It's All About Food. Oh, we're coming to the end. Well, I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been It's All About Food. Find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Read my daily blog, What Vegans Eat. We've got great recipes for the holidays for you, and have a delicious week. We'll be right back.